What role did Gandhi's 2 decades living in South Africa play in his life? Jyothi Thottam will join us to talk about her review of Gandhi Before India by Ramachandra Guha.
The African struggle was a different struggle. Basically, it wasn't my fight.
What would you do if a terrorist tried to kill you? Anand Giridharadas will be here to discuss his new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas.
10 years later, this immigrant who survived decides to dramatically re-enter the life of the attacker who shot him.
Sarah Smith will join us to talk about new children's books for spring. And my colleagues, John Williams and Parul Sehgal, and I will talk about what's going on this week in the book business. Finally, Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Jyothi Thottam joins us now to talk about her review of a new biography of Gandhi. This is the first in a two-volume biography called Gandhi Before India by Ramachandra Guha. Hi, Jyothi.
Hi.
So I think a lot of our listeners may not be aware that that Gandhi had this whole life in South Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about the timeline? When did he go to South Africa? How long was he there?
Well, it's interesting. He was really part of sort of a wave of migration out of the Indian subcontinent to other parts of the empire. This happened in the late 1800s when a lot of Indians were leaving. In his case, it was really interesting because he came from a family of sort of minor bureaucrats, civil servants, but they were attached to one of the princely states, a king, a kind of minor king in Gujarat. But then the king sort of lost his status. The family's position became very precarious. He was one of a few brothers, and he basically had to find his way in the world.
He was educated in England.
Well, he was, although the reason why he went to England, it was very interesting. He basically couldn't hack it in the local college. He was failing out, and then a family friend said, well, you know, you could go to England. Like, that was kind of the safety, like the backup.
The safety school of the day.
Yeah, so he went to become a lawyer in England. You know, that was kind of a transformative experience, which he writes about himself in his own autobiography. You know, his first time leaving India, he was became very close friends with a group of vegetarians, kind of the counterculture of the time in England. And then he came back to India, tried to become a lawyer, pretty much failed again, heard that there were opportunities for Indians to work in South Africa, essentially to work serving the small Indian immigrant population in South Africa. And that's what he did. He went there the first time, just kind of working on one case. Then he left. He was about to leave and then came back because he was put on a retainer by a group of South Asian, basically Gujarati Muslim merchants who needed kind of their man, like a lawyer who would serve their interests. So essentially, he was kind of like a paid community organizer. And he said, okay, well, now I've got my foothold. This was the first kind of real living. That's how he ended up in South Africa.
I think it's, you know, it's interesting for those who only know the Richard Attenborough version of his life, that not only did he have this whole life in England and then 2 decades in South Africa, but he was not sort of a success and a force from the get-go, but he had all of these very significant setbacks.
He really did. And I'm glad you mentioned the Gandhi movie, because I know definitely for Indian Americans of my generation, but I think for a lot of people in the West and even in India, that movie is kind of the picture that most people have of Gandhi. I mean, I remember very vividly.
All think he's Ben Kingsley,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, exactly. Poor Ben Kingsley. I remember very vividly my parents taking me out of school when I was 11 years old so that we could all go as a family, my sister and my parents, in the middle of the afternoon to see this movie, because it was such a huge thing. And I'll never forget, like, the sound of a theater full of adults weeping at this movie. I mean, it was just like such a transformative, powerful thing. And I mean, it's just a very well-made biopic, like most movies about famous people, very kind of simplified. But I think pretty much every biography of Gandhi after that has really had to grapple with that movie more than other biographies, in a sense, almost more than Gandhi's own writing about himself. I mean, the combination of Gandhi's works about himself and the movie created this kind of huge myth of the man that every other biography has kind of had to answer to. And I think what's so interesting about Ram Guha's book is that it's the first biography of Gandhi that I've read that is kind of equally cinematic. I mean, it's sort of vivid enough, there's enough detail that it's almost like it can replace that movie running in your head about what Gandhi's life was really like. And it's, in a way, like way more interesting than the movie, because you get this picture of him as really, a struggling young husband and father. You know, he couldn't bring his family when he first went to South Africa, so he did not have a close relationship with his sons. You know, he wasn't really sure how they were going to get educated, about their career. You know, he admitted in letters to his wife that he was kind of a failure as a husband. I mean, he had these very basic human struggles that come through not only in his letters with other people, but also in the primary sources that Ram Guha digs up, the letters of Gandhi's friends and contemporaries mm-hmm. about him, to him.
I want to talk about his research in a minute. But before that, just for those people who are sitting there simultaneously adding Gandhi to their Netflix list because they realize they haven't seen it in so long or never saw it to begin with, what does that movie get wrong? I mean, was there anything that you read in this book in particular that made you think, oh, wow, you know, looking back, that was quite inaccurate?
Right. Well, you know, one of the big revelations, and this was even sort of big news back in India when the book was published there.
When was the book published in India?
It was earlier this year, I think in January. Mm-hmm. It was the first meeting between Gandhi and Jinnah. And in the movie, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who's the founder of Pakistan, but at the time they were both in the movie. You see them meeting
at a party.
Yeah, at a garden party, and you know they're kind of portrayed as these perfect opposites. You know, Gandhi is this kind of otherworldly, saintly ascetic in a turban, and he's meeting all these freedom fighters, many of whom are very well educated, and Jinnah in particular is kind of in a vest and a suit and a monocle. I mean, it's he did actually wear a monocle, but
the, that part they got
yeah,
right.
The contrast is really striking. But one of the things that Ram Guha dug up in his research was a logbook of correspondence that Gandhi kept when he was a lawyer in
South
Africa.
And he kept very good records.
Very meticulous records. It was amazing. I mean, he wrote just a copious amount. I mean, he wrote letters the way that we all send text messages now. And there is an entry, two letters, 6 months apart. And it's not clear exactly what was in the letters, but it was definitely a record of Jinnah writing to Gandhi twice in that time when Gandhi was in South Africa. And it's just fascinating to think that, actually they had so much in common. I mean, they were both from the same part of Gujarat, both would have, grown up in Gujarati-speaking households, both educated in England as lawyers, and both essentially struggled to find careers as lawyers. And so, Guha speculates very carefully, but he speculates that, he could have been writing to him to kind of ask about opportunities in South Africa, as any other, young lawyer might. So you really kind of rethink what was the relationship between these two people.
I think one thing that comes through in your review of the book is that the author, Guha, was incredibly meticulous with his research mm-hmm. as well, and also very careful not to overreach or over-psychologize. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about his approach and how that either strengthened mm-hmm. the book or I don't know if it was a detraction in any way.
It's true. He's very careful, and in a sense he can be, because he has this tremendous trove of letters, colonial correspondence, official correspondence, personal letters, and he really spent kind of the last 20 years of his life, Guha did, collecting this material. I mean, this is a project that he's been working on for many, many years. He found records and archives in Israel, England, I mean, all over the world, and some of which has not really been used before, like letters between Gandhi and Henry Pollock, who was a close friend of his. And you just sort of get a picture of Gandhi that isn't really in the popular imagination right now. I mean, this person who at one point was living with his wife and this European couple, Henry Pollack and his wife, in sort of a farm in South Africa. I mean, this was a very unconventional arrangement.
Yes.
And it was part of his sort of search for justice, kind of a way to live a good life.
I thought one of the most interesting parts of your review is you write about the fact that Gandhi had his own interactions with the South Africans and with their own national movements, nascent nationalist mm-hmm. movements. And does it become clear in this book that they informed in some way his own political awakening, the development of his own political thought?
They did, in a sense. And there have been a couple of books written recently kind of questioning, you know, why was it that Gandhi, who spent such a, you know, a long period of his life in South Africa, why was he not more actively engaged with the African freedom movement? And I think the conclusion that Guha comes to is that he was definitely aware of what was going on, but he came to a point in his thinking where he realized that, you know, the Indian struggle is my struggle, and that is ultimately what he was going to pursue. And the African struggle was a different struggle. Basically, it wasn't my fight.
Right. And in a way that then echoes mm-hmm. much of what he felt that the Indians needed to do for themselves.
Absolutely. And ultimately, that's why he left South Africa. He'd kind of done everything that he could do for Indians as this kind of small minority group. And then he kind of got to a point, he was becoming very famous. There was just kind of nothing that he could do anymore. There's one letter from one of his contemporaries, a missionary whom he became very close to, who wrote to someone else about Gandhi that essentially he was played out in South Africa. He just needed to leave.
Well, he leaves in 1914. That's where the book leaves off. And obviously there is much then that he does after that. Presumably we'll read about it in part two of this major new biography. The book again is Gandhi Before India by Ramachandra Guha. And Jyothi Totham, thank you so much for reviewing this for us and for being here.
Thanks so much.
Anand Giridharadas joins us now to talk about his new book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Hi, Anand.
Hi.
So this is an amazing story, this true story that you used as the basis of the book. For those not familiar with the story of what happened shortly after 9/11, tell us.
So right after 9/11, with the whole country in a fever and the reruns of those planes hitting the towers, looping, a lot of us were anguished, and a very small number of us went into a craze. And in this case, a man named Mark Stroman in Dallas decided that he had to avenge 9/11 all by himself and went to three different gas stations, Arab hunting, as he called it.
This was a self-proclaimed American terrorist.
He called himself an American terrorist. He called himself an allied combatant up against the enemy combatants that he was kind of hearing about on the news. And he was confident that the Bush administration was going to do nothing about this terror problem. So walked into these three gas stations and proceeded to shoot each of three brown-skinned clerks that he found behind the counters. Two of them died immediately.
And were they Arab?
None of them were Arab. He was not a successful Arab hunter, but he was a murderous guy because he killed a Pakistani and an Indian clerk. And in the third case, a man named Raisuddin Buyan, who was a Bangladeshi immigrant, recent immigrant, an Air Force officer in his country, had kind of, in a way, lowered himself by working in a gas station in America after having this illustrious post, but really had this American dream that so many of our ancestors have had to make it here, and was working in this gas station selling three tamales for a dollar to people. And Mark Stroman walks in and shoots him too. But in his case, Stroman used a Derringer pistol and shot birdshot, a pellet of birdshot, into his head. And so 39 pellets entered his head. They're still in his head. Blinded his right eye, almost reached his brain, but spared his life. And to fast forward through a lot of it, 10 years later, and that's why there's a book, 10 years later, this immigrant who survived decides to dramatically re-enter the life of the attacker who shot him.
Okay, I'm going to press rewind before we talk about what happened a decade later. One of the amazing things that happens in the immediate aftermath is that despite having these 39 pellets of bird shot in his head, he is dismissed from the hospital the very next day.
It's 2001. Being shot in the face was apparently a pre-existing condition. And because he did not have health insurance, they let him go the next day, even though his mouth wasn't moving, his eye was caked shut with blood, he could barely talk. And you have to see this from his perspective. You and I might sit here and know that's not a good sign. But he was a guy from one of the poorest countries in the world who had come to the richest country in the world. He was not in a secular hospital. He was in a religious Christian hospital. He thought, they would never do anything to me that wasn't in my best interest. If they're sending me out of here, it must be because, contrary to appearances, I'm going to do great. And it took him time to understand that in America, if you don't have insurance, you're the hospital's problem, and the hospital doesn't want you to be their problem. So once you're stabilized, according to some legal definition, you're out the door.
Okay, before we get to Stroman, let's talk about Bouillon's recovery and what happened in the 10 intervening years.
So he, in some ways, lived through a lot of different dimensions of what doesn't work and what works in America. So he, lived through healthcare not really working. He lived through debt, chronic problem in American lives. It went $60,000 into medical debt and kind of became this fog from which he could barely escape. Couldn't treat untreated depression because he didn't have money, couldn't figure out clinics. So that was kind of the beginning, and was homeless because the gas station owner who had brought him to Texas, whose house he was living in, didn't really find a lot of value in him once race stopped splitting the mortgage.
Unbelievable.
So that was the America that in a way didn't work. But then, within a few years, he found ways of rebuilding and was able through, one connection to get a job at the Olive Garden. And he kind of wanted to get back out there. He said, I wanted to get over my fear of white people. And the Olive Garden is obviously a very, potentially great place to do that.
And this was a real cross-cultural experience for him as a practicing Muslim. You write that he was recommending wine to...
Well, at first he said, I can't sell this wine. And then he learned very quickly that in America, that's saying, I don't want 50% of my potential income here. And he said, well, maybe God's not that harsh. It's okay if I sell it as long as I don't drink it. So he then starts selling it. And then he thinks, if I'm going to sell this, I might as well be good at it. And he learns to, as he puts it, describe wine as crispy, chocolatey, or spicy, depending on which bottle people were inquiring
and
about.
And he goes to Mecca then.
He goes to Mecca after the Olive Garden helps him get a house. He gets back on his feet. He resolves his debts in part through a government grant. Once his debt free, is free to go to Mecca under his interpretation of the faith. And there in Mecca, there's a bunch of little signs, including someone falling on him and he breaks his nose. And he interprets all these little signs as God kind of tapping him on the shoulder and giving him a message. And it takes him a while to decipher it. But he remembers very clearly that when he was dying, as he thought, in 2001, he lay on the floor of that convenience store, looked up to the sky and said, if you save me now to God, I will dedicate the rest of my life to others. And then he hadn't, because of all the things we've just talked about, debt and healthcare and whatever else. And in 2009, having become an American citizen, having healed himself, he understood now was time. Now was my time to do something grand for humanity.
And he decides to then help Stroman, the person who tried to kill him. Let's go back to Stroman. Who is Mark Stroman?
Mark Stroman is in many ways his own aberration of a man. But in many ways is an embodiment of what we read about all the time, of a kind of white working class in America that has fallen, very far behind over the last generation.
A tough childhood, too.
Very tough childhood. Almost all the things that limit a child's possibilities were present in his story. So an abusive stepfather who we thought was his father and only found out later was his stepfather. A mother who told him, if I'd had $50 more, I would have aborted you, but I unfortunately did not have those $50. He had a grass allergy and therefore was made to go, pick the grass with his hands. And then passed through, starting with a kind of dismal family, and clearly he had his own problems as well, passed through, two other failing institutions in American life, which is the public school system and the mass incarceration system.
Okay. So he is sentenced to death in Texas for one of the murders of the three people whom he shot that day.
He is. And so in 2002, in the spring of 2002, he's sentenced and goes to the Polunsky unit in Livingston, Texas to serve out his sentence. A very interesting thing happens well before Race returns to his life, which is that all the people he knew until 2001 basically fall out of his life. He sees almost none of them ever again. All the influences that made him. And all the new people that enter his life once he's on death row, because in death row you're not really with other people in the prisoners except 1 hour a day. You're by yourself. So the people who entered his life through letters, through pen pals, all these Europeans who write pen pal letters to Americans on death row, ministers, religious people, an Israeli documentary filmmaker, they were all wonderful people. And you actually see how quickly a 30-something-year-old man starts to change once you take away all the negative peers and introduce him to only good peers. And he starts to become self-aware. He starts over years to kind of come to terms with what allowed him to be so rotten and goes on kind of his own journey of finding God and kind of finding some real untarnished version of himself.
So now it's 2009. Bouillon decides to work on Stroman's behalf. What does he then go do?
So that kind of began in 2009. It took about a year of kind of researching, going on the web, talking to people, trying to figure out, okay, I'm an immigrant in this country. What can I do? I can, you know, donate money to charity, but if I want to do something big, what can I do? He thought finally that the thing that most pained him in the world was that his two great allegiances, his faith and his citizenship, American and Islam, were at loggerheads. And it's like when you have two best friends and they don't get along. It's painful. Mm-hmm. You don't understand. What don't they like about each other? Because I see they're both so wonderful. And these are the two halves of his identity in a way now. And he said, I'm going to intervene in this Islam-America standoff. And how can I intervene? And finally came to the idea that I want to forgive this kind of white supremacist, Texan, true American, as he called himself, who shot me. But more than that, I want to fight a legal campaign against the state of Texas, against the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who was announcing his run for president that month. And I want to fight them to save Stroman from the death penalty.
How does Stroman find out about his efforts, and what does he think?
You know, Stroman by that point had become a blogger, as some people on death row are, through a kind of elaborate system of sending letters out. And he both responded on his blog and to his lawyer that he said he called it the greatest act of kindness he'd ever known, that no one had ever been so kind to him in his life. And by that point, he'd already changed, and not changed because of race, changed because of a lot of other people in his life, but was able and ready to receive this change, and he thanked him. And the two men actually were able to finally have a phone call.
All right. I don't want you to tell us any more about what happens, because I think people should read the book. Let's just talk about how you came to this story. What made you decide to write about this?
It was actually very roundabout. So I was in India for several years, working as a foreign correspondent in the country where my parents had actually left, and they had come to America, and I'd kind of moved back to India after college, reversed their journey, and was working as a journalist. The big story I was getting to tell in India and wrote a book about was the coming of something like the American dream to this intensely stratified and poor society, and this the rise of hope and the idea of the individual and people kind of being able to feel like they could break fate. And I came back to America in 2009, and it seemed like everything I was seeing and hearing was about that same process that I'd witnessed in India, except backwards, that we were becoming over here a kind of caste society when India was just finally figuring out how to stop being one. You know, there were little trends like more and more people, because they couldn't afford their own homes, were like living in these like multi-generational, multi-sibling and spouse families. That's exactly what India was starting to get out of.
Right.
And there was this weird reversal. And so I wanted to do something about kind of the American dream, who it still works for and who it doesn't. And I needed a vessel. And I spent a year and a half, you know, reading little local news stories on the web, trying to find some great little story. And then one day saw a little news brief in the Times, of all places.
And you get a lot of really good book ideas and larger stories out of those news briefs.
And I told myself, I can't find it in the Times, because if it's in the Times, it's too late to be a book. But it was a kind of little enough news brief. And it just mentioned the kind of the crime, and the fact that Reis Bouillon was fighting to save this guy's life. And I just thought, I've never heard that before.
Who is the true American of the title?
If there was one, it would be, you know, an article or a blog post and not a book. I think they both, although in this particular case, people may be, you know, much more drawn to, you know, one of these people than the other. In a larger sense, there are rival visions of the American dream here that are actually valid. I think there's a vision of the American dream of just churn and constant newness. And there's another vision that says, you know, a great country has to also preserve some things and kind of not just give itself over to the latest. But I think more than that, it's about two different experiences rather than just visions of the American dream. And the central irony of the story for me is you have a guy who came here from the real third world. But he, despite getting shot, actually got to experience a first world America. Mm-hmm. Because after he got shot, he rebuilt, he worked at the Olive Garden, he learned IT, and now he makes six figures running a team of server engineers in Austria from his base in Murphy, Texas, out of his house.
Wow.
And he was able to live a first world America. And like most of us who live in first world America, he might never have even really realized that there was a third world America right among us if he hadn't gotten shot by someone who came out of it. But because he got shot, he was forced to confront another experience of the American dream. And at the heart of his act of forgiveness was this realization that he had a shot at this country as an outsider that a lot of people born in this country never have.
All right. Well, clearly many layers and a complicated story. The book is The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. Anand, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm joined now by Parul Sehgal and John Williams to talk a little bit about this week's issue and what's going on elsewhere in the book world. Hi, Parul. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela.
Parul, let's talk first about this issue, which is not quite a theme issue, but we did decide to dedicate our cover and a chunk of the book review to writing from and about the subcontinent.
We're showing a little love to the subcontinent this week. There has been this flourishing of really, really interesting writing coming out of India and Pakistan and that region. I mean, these books are very different. So, for example, we have a review of Rana Das Gupta's book, Capital, which is a book about Delhi. We have Sonia Falero on a book about a little troubled city called Patna. A book is called A Matter of Rats by Amitava Kumar. We have a book about partition. We have a book about Gandhi before he moved to India and his sort of political organizing work in South Africa. There's a book on a sort of little known, very scandalous Indian writer named Manto. All these books are, they're slightly different, but what they do seem to have in common is that they're doing a really, really interesting form of storytelling. A lot of them are drawing on, you know, pretty rigorous reporting. But then they're also trying to tell local stories, which if you've been following writing coming out of India, is something new. India is a country that, and India and Pakistan, that entire region, that generalizations are very liberally applied. So to tell smaller stories and to tell stories that are, you know, deeply reported and idiosyncratic and stylish feels exciting and new.
We talked earlier to Anand Giridharadas about his book, The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas, which on the face of it doesn't seem to be about the subcontinent, but of course it is about a Bangladeshi immigrant and the lines between America and the subcontinent. Mm-hmm. And similarly, we spoke with Jyothi Totham about her review of Gandhi Before India, which again is really a lot about South Africa. And I think what all of these books make clear is that while they are concerned with the subcontinent, that the lines aren't as distinct, and that sort of in our globalized consciousness and reality, this is not, these are not books about other people.
Absolutely. And these are not fixed identities either. So one of the books that I was talking about was a book called Bombay Stories by Manto, and it's reviewed by Suketu Mehta. And it's about a writer who is, it goes from being Indian to Pakistani. And like, so the idea that like our borders are also, the borders in the subcontinent are very new, 1947. So the sense of being an Indian or the sense of being an American or South African, when we're talking about a diaspora and we're talking about individuals that have shifted and sort of these tides of history, it is something that is constantly being negotiated, being understood.
You know, another reason I think that it made sense to group these books together is that I think that the whole idea of, you know, there being sort of one book about India Absolutely. In a year and sort of, you know, that suffices.
That's right.
And
that's right.
And that tells the whole story. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that people are becoming aware that that's just not the case.
No, it's true. And that there's so many different ways of writing about the subcontinent. I think you and I were talking a bit before about how from the 70s, 80s, and a bit in the 90s, there was this huge flourishing of what people were calling the Indian novel.
Right. If you read A Suitable Boy, then you knew it all.
You knew it all. You knew it all, right?
And you were done.
I think a lot of these books, this is sort of a trend that I've been seeing happening for the last, like, you know, 5-6 years, are aggressively against this idea that there can be one such story.
I mean, one of the things that interested me about the Patna book in particular, maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, is that here's a city that nobody in America, or I shouldn't say nobody, not very many Americans have heard of this city, and yet there's a lot going on
there. There's so much going on. I mean, it's a story that even that Kumar talks about. Americans may not have heard about Patna, but to Indians, Patna is a joke. I'm trying to think of the American equivalent. Like, what is that city that's so riddled with crime and graft and corruption and is swarmed by rats? It's such a joke. So it's a book about, it's his love letter to this city that's just been disparaged and misunderstood, but has been at the heart of so many amazing cultural moments, be it like, you know, the Buddha or E.M. Forster's Book of Passage to India is set there. So I mean, or even now where it's, we see in relief, these bigger trends, these bigger sort of, you know, economic inequality. You see the ravages of globalization. You see all of these things happening in this particular small place.
Is there a book in here that you are particularly excited about as a reader?
You know, I'm excited about the book Bombay Stories because Mantu is a writer who I didn't know. And Sukheta Mehta has enormously charming and funny review, I think. Sort of made the case for why he might be the greatest South Asian writer we have. Also in part because he does talk about little corners of India that I've never been to. I didn't know existed. And I'm excited to spend some time with that book.
All right, I'm going to switch over and talk a little bit about a very local New York story, which has to do with our New York Public Library. Some big news there, John.
Very big news, actually, and kind of unlikely news. I mean, things like this don't tend to happen, but there's been a reversal of a plan that the New York Public Library had to renovate its main research library, which is the big flagship building on Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. And they were going to change the stacks underneath the building, which are these giant catacombs of books for scholars and researchers.
I've been down there.
You
it's
have?
Fabulous.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's underneath Bryant Park is actually these, you know, long catacombs.
Right, so everyone's picnicking
books.
On the grass in Bryant Park, and underneath there are all these. And so they were going to move those stacks and change the library into a circulating library. And this plan met with a lot of resistance. It was a very expensive plan, but also scholars and writers, including Salman Rushdie and Francine Prose, David Nassau, and the writer Caleb Crane, who's written a lot about this, just didn't think it was a good plan. It was sort of aimed at recognizing the digital future and kind of lessening the importance of having physical books around. And I think scholars thought that it would be a real blow to serious research. And so I don't think it's entirely clear what the long-term plan is now going to be, but they have sort of put the brakes on this idea and now are, you know, rethinking. And I think with the help of de Blasio and Mayor Bill de Blasio and others, they're going to come up with a new plan.
It's so interesting because the New York Public Library holds sort of two very different functions at its main branch. I mean, it is a library that is for the public. It's, although it is not a public institution, which a lot of people believe it is for the public. and, you know, is meant to provide books that people can borrow, but it's also a site for scholarly research, and there are a lot of important collections there. And there was this plan, I think, were they going to put them across the Hudson River or some?
Yeah, they were going to put them in Jersey.
Distance.
And, and it was going to take longer to get to them, and also just, you know, to not have them. And to be honest, in reading about this for the last couple of days, I do think some of this is still up in the air. I'm not sure that all of the books that people wanted to keep at the library are still going to be there, but so I think that there's still a lot to be determined here. But the president of the library, Anthony Marks, was quoted in our paper as saying, when the facts change, the only right thing to do as a public-serving institution is to take a look with fresh eyes and see if there is a way to improve the plans. And just that alone, I think, in this day and age is very refreshing to hear.
It's, you know, it's actually quite remarkable, I think, especially with New York cultural institutions, because if you've lived here for decades, you see this story replay over and over again, whether it's the MoMA or Lincoln Center or the Met, where one of these great institutions announced some kind of change. And for a very forward-looking city. We New Yorkers are remarkably resistant to anyone sort of messing with our treasured institutions. And generally what happens is they plow ahead and everyone puts up, you know, a great deal of fuss and gets angry and upset, and then it comes out and everyone embraces it.
Right.
But this was, you know, again, one of the rare times where that was sort of stopped.
The fuss has at least for now won, which is very rare, and it hasn't just been steamrolled by the developers and plans for big changes. And I think that for, you know, most New Yorkers who value our heritage, which is a lot of them, that's a welcome headline.
Okay. Well, we will leave on that cheery note. Thanks so much, John and Pearl.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Pamela.
Our children's book editor, Sarah Smith, joins us now to talk about our spring special feature this week, which has about 10 pages of picture books, middle grade novels, nonfiction, and YA. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
So one of the exciting things I thought about this particular issue is some new and unexpected, as well as some highly credentialed and experienced critics in the issue. We open with one of the biggest names in YA fiction right now, Meg Rossoff.
That's right. Meg Rossoff is a wonderful YA writer whose last novel, Picture Me Gone, was a finalist for the National Book Award in Young Adult Fiction. And she wrote a great, really interesting and thoughtful review of E. Lockhart's new book, We Were Liars, which is getting a lot of attention because it has a super surprise ending, which everyone's being very good about keeping quiet. That's right. So very pleased to have Meg Rossoff in our pages.
And that book also is a potential big crossover with adult readers.
That's right. I read it myself, and honestly, I didn't think that I needed to be an adolescent to enjoy it as much as I did. We also have two wonderful actors writing for us this month, which is very surprising and terrific. The first more surprising one is Maude Apatow, who is a young actor, and you might have seen her recently in This Is 40. She's a high school student in Los Angeles, and she reviewed a book in diary form by a eighth grader who, at the time that she wrote the book, was living in Texas, called Popular. And Maya Van Wagenen, the author of that book, took as a project for a year the idea of following a 1950s etiquette book to the letter. So Maude is reviewing this interesting book about what middle school is like if you wear a girdle, wear red lipstick, pantyhose, and try to be nice to everybody.
You know, it's funny. We have really wanted for a long time to have a teenager reviewing books that are actually for teenagers, ostensibly, even though others may enjoy them as well. We've had interns from the New York Times internship scholarship program who have just graduated from high school write a couple of reviews for us. But this was kind of the first time really going out there and trying to find someone. I'd love the idea of Maude in particular doing this review because her father, Judd Apatow, of course, director, writer, creator of Freaks and Geeks, knows a little bit of something, I think, about high school and junior high social dynamics. So it was fun to have her weigh in on this. And I think her voice and experience really shines through in her review.
It was a very thoughtful review, almost surprisingly so, from somebody that age. And she was really reflecting on the hell that is middle school and how difficult it is to navigate that, even with the help of the best etiquette book.
Now, our other Hollywood celebrity here is an accomplished actor, of course, but also, I think not everyone realizes, a children's book author himself. So he knows the genre, and that is?
John Lithgow. And he was such a great professional writer to work with. He completely blew me away with the quality of his criticism. He's written 9 children's books, the last of which we reviewed in a bookshelf recently. I believe it's called Never Play Music Next to the Zoo. He also performed music on an accompanying CD. It's a great kids' book, and he reviewed here some lovely books about spring and the seasons.
And then there are a couple of very seasoned book critics who are familiar, I think, to our readers, but it was great to have in our pages Roger Sutton, of course, one of them from the Horn book. I also was excited that Steve Schenken contributed a review, a nonfiction review.
That's right. Steve Schenken is a really respected writer of nonfiction for young people. He wrote a book called Bomb, which was absolutely fascinating. More recently, a book about discrimination in the Army during the Second World War, which I reviewed online. And he was looking at a new nonfiction book called D-Day by Rick Atkinson, who had written a longer version of a similar book for adults. So this is kind of a redacted for kids book, but very successful, very interesting. And I know I learned a lot about it. It was great to hear Steve's thoughts about how you write for young people. And one of the things that he said was that you really don't get any, you don't do any favors by dumbing it down. And this book is a good example of a nonfiction book that sets a very high standard.
All right, let's talk very quickly before we go about our particular favorites. As an editor, a critic, and a reader, and a parent of readers, did you have a favorite book on the list?
Well, I had so many favorites in this issue. It's really hard to say, but I will say that among the picture books, Michael Ian Black's book, Naked.
That was mine.
It's extremely cute. You know, it's very short, not too many words, but in this book, a completely adorable little boy escapes from the bathroom after his bath without putting on any clothes, and he runs through the house trying to avoid getting dressed. And there's just something about the rhythm of the text and the really cute pictures together, which makes for a very, very funny book, which will be a familiar story to a lot of parents.
I'm going to also call out one more picture book that I found to be very lovely, which is Hannah's Night, written and illustrated by Kamoko Sakai and reviewed in this issue by Roger Sutton. Just a really sweet story of a girl who can't sleep, wakes up in the middle of the night. She has her cat by the side, and they go through those little nighttime rituals that children will do after dark before once again settling in. It's the kind of book I think that sometimes parents are scared of because they think, is this going to give my child any ideas, or is my child going to get out after I tuck them in if they read this? But it's such a sweet tale, and it's beautifully illustrated, so I highly recommend that one.
I love that one, too. I think it's a great place to start.
Sarah, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Not a whole lot this week, actually. There are three new titles on the hardcover fiction list. Down at number 12, a woman named Francine Rivers has a novel called Bridge to Haven that is about a movie star during kind of golden age Hollywood who eventually finds her way back to the happier life that she's always been looking for. She finds Hollywood unfulfilling. Our listeners will immediately recognize that that is a Christian story based on Ezekiel 16, or so book list tells me.
Not so our next book.
The next book is Iris Johansson's Live to See Tomorrow, new at number 11 on the list. It continues Johansson's Catherine Ling series about a CIA operative. Then all the way up at number 2, Greg Iles, the thriller writer, has a new novel out called Not Just Burning. Iles has been a regular bestseller. He had a book on the list every 2 years or so, starting in about 2001. In 2011, just as he was about to publish this book, he was putting the finishing touches on it, he was in a terrible car crash, and he was in a coma for 8 days. He tore his aorta. And as he was recovering from that, and also thinking about the death of his father a year earlier, he decided, you know what, this book isn't everything I want it to be. Life's too short. Mortality was on his mind, and he decided to just tear up the whole thing, revisit it. He's now made it 800 pages long. It's the first part of a trilogy. He's taking his writing a lot more seriously, he says, than he used to. And here it is at new at number 2.
Rewarded for his efforts.
Yeah. On the nonfiction side of things, I want to note that Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, has risen to the top of the list. So Harvard University Press is there with a number one nonfiction bestseller. Maybe the first time that has ever happened for Harvard.
Ce n'est pas impossible!
But there is also one new title on the list this week, and that is Diane Keaton's new memoir, Let's Just Say It Wasn't Pretty.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.